MacCast, Wednesday, July 3rd, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be here with you once again. Well, it looks like we've got another big show for you. There's been a lot going on in the Apple and Mac communities over the last week or so. I always think that we're going to run out of stuff to talk about, but that never seems to be the case. Lots going on, including Apple not seeming to be able to control images leaking out on its new iPhone products. We got a bunch of new components and things to look at in that part of Apple's universe. Also, some stuff on new iPads. We're starting to hear a little bit about benchmarks on some of those new Mac models that are out there. We're going to talk about those, and some of those new Macs are having some issues that we'll talk about as well. We've got software updates and a bunch of other stuff, including some international news. Always happy when we can talk a little bit about what's going on internationally with Apple. And then we'll get into your feedback and questions and things like that. We got a lot of questions related to iTunes, Music Match, and just managing your files and documents, some backup questions as well to get to. So it's going to be a big show, a lot of fun. But before we get into all of that, let me take a moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's ShareFile by Citrix. You know, in business, we rely a lot on sending and receiving important materials. You might have an important business contract, a PDF that you need to get to someone. You might have a presentation you're working on, a keynote or a PowerPoint. You might have an important Word document or Pages document that you need to share. But with online services and online boxes, there can be some potential risks in sending and sharing confidential files. There can also be problems with using something as simple as email attachments to send a document back and forth. I think we've all had that problem where you go to send a document, an important critical file, and it gets bounced either by your server or by the receiving server. There's no guarantee that that attachment can go through, especially if it's a large file. You also don't have a lot of control when sending an email attachment on who receives the file. You can have the situation where you accidentally mistype an email address or it picks up the wrong address from your contacts. I've received documents that maybe I shouldn't have seen from people by mistake, and that's not an experience that you want to have. And ShareFile is specifically designed to handle those kinds of issues and more, and do it easily and securely. It lets you send documents of almost any size, and it does it through simple links that you put into your email. So you're not going to get the bounce backs that you would by sending traditional email attachments. And best of all, it has controls to allow you to track when documents are downloaded and by who they are downloaded, and has additional controls and security that you can layer in there. So if you're working on a project, you can control who has access to different documents, and you can see it all and manage it all through ShareFile. It allows you to store your files in the cloud so you can access them from anywhere. A lot of us are working remotely, and they have clients for iOS devices, Android, BlackBerry, Windows Phone, your tablet, your smartphone, your computer. It doesn't matter what you're working on or where you are. You can work completely on the go. So it has a lot of versatility layered on top of that security. And that's a challenging thing, to be able to mix ease of use along with versatility and still have all those layers of security is a pretty big deal. Added level of security that I found my clients like a lot is they allow you to have a branded URL and website for clients to download or upload documents into your share file. So if I need to have one of my clients send me a large file, that's always been a challenge in the past. With ShareFile, I can simply send them a link. They show up on a page that has my logo, so they know that they're sending the file to the right person. They upload it through a simple web interface, and it lands in my share file folders for the right project. I know when the person uploaded, I can get a notification, and if I'm out and about, I can even access that file right from my iPhone. So it really is a different approach to business file sharing, and I think it's really worth taking a look at. So if you haven't checked it out, you can try it free with my special offer. You can sign up today, get a free 30-day trial, no obligation. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter my promo code MACCAST. Remember, visit sharefile.com and type in MACCAST. You can try it out for 30 days, and I think you're going to like it. So sharefile.com, and a big thank you to Citrix and ShareFile for their support of the MACCAST. I mentioned it at the top of the show, but it seems to me like there are more and more leaked photos continuing to expose details on Apple's upcoming iPhone products, at least reportedly, right? We have no way to confirm. A lot of these tend to be potentially photoshopped images just based on specs and rumors that are out there. You don't have a lot of confirmation, so you have to take all of these with a grain of salt, but we seem to have had a lot more images coming out of Asia and Europe, the various blogs, reportedly showing different kinds of things, component parts for the new iPhones, cases, and in some instances, even the actual devices themselves, or at least them in various states of assembly. And it's pretty much believed that we're going to see some new devices in the fall. So the timing right now makes sense that Apple is putting a lot of this stuff into production. It's at various vendors throughout Asia, and there might be people snapping some spy shots. So we take these with a grain of salt, but here's some of the latest specs that we've been hearing about this week. On the iPhone 5S, the images do seem to indicate that it will have a dual LED flash. That's one of the specs we've been hearing about. It's also believed that it'll have a higher resolution camera. I don't think we've seen images of the camera sensor. I don't think, at least I've run across any, but we have seen several images reportedly of the dual LED flash, and the latest ones make it look like it would be in two different colors. It's actually what one analyst was calling a smart flash. Supposedly, the two LEDs could be fired together or independently based on various lighting conditions and the kinds of photos that you're taking, and offer better photo quality in different lighting conditions, especially low light. So the next gen iPhone is supposed to do a better job at low light exposures. As far as the sensor itself, the EyeSight camera is thought to be possibly a 12 megapixel sensor in the iPhone 5S. The current one is 8 megapixels. So a pretty significant bump up in the specifications for the camera on the next-gen iPhone. We've also been seeing various images of reportedly the iPhone mainboard. And in the past, we did not see images with a processor in place, but this week there was some images that seemed to indicate a new chip, possibly the A7. The image only has an Apple logo, does not have any A branding on it, but it is stamped with various numbers. The A series, the A6 series, actually carried a number APL0598. This latest image showed APL0698, so would seem to indicate a bump up in the processor number. Again, these things are often photoshopped, so we can't be certain, but it would make sense that that would be the next generation numbering on the chip. The number on the chip also seems to indicate potentially a new manufacturer. We'd been hearing rumors that Apple was trying to move processors over to Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, TSMC, moving away from Samsung. But it seems like for now that Apple will be sticking with Samsung at least through 2014. So the fact that this one seemed to have a different letter on it that would indicate potentially a different supplier, component supplier for the chip, potentially takes away a little bit from the legitimacy. But another thing with these images, we often see prototypes, and we had heard rumors that TSMC was doing some test runs of A-series chips for Apple, so it could be one of those A7s that was just a proof of concept to see if TSMC could handle the manufacturing and get to the production yields that Apple was needing. So don't know, but did see some processor images over the last week. Also, we're hearing more, a little bit more about the fingerprint sensor or the potential fingerprint sensor that might end up in the home button. There was an image that showed a home button with an Apple logo on it, which was odd to see. Apple typically doesn't put their branding on the front of their devices. I don't think they've ever, no, I know for a fact they've never done it on an iPhone. And this had a home button with a full Apple logo on it in place of the little square that Apple usually would use. So that would be very odd to do, but the story I was reading was postulating that maybe Apple was doing it because they needed a larger window for the fingerprint scanner. I don't specifically know how the scanning technology works. Apple bought a fingerprint scanning company, but if it does need to sort of see through the button to your finger, having a big open Apple logo on there could provide the space. It seems a little brash for Apple's design, but it could make sense. There was also some indications that Apple has a patent out there for fingerprint scanning on the bezel of your device. So what would happen is as you slide your finger across or over the bezel of your phone, it could analyze slices of your fingerprint, assemble them back together, and use that for fingerprint scanning. That would be a more elegant way, I think, for Apple to handle that sort of thing. But all of the rumors we've been hearing so far is that Apple was trying to build a fingerprint scanner into the home button on your iPhone, although it was proving to be challenging. So this could just be, again, a proof of concept, something Apple was playing around with in prototypes, not necessarily something that we'll see on a production model iPhone, but an interesting image nonetheless. And then according to the Korea Times, the 5S may also support new, more advanced LTE networks, 150 megabit per second advanced LTE. The rumor is based on comments from an unnamed executive at SK Telecom, who says they've been negotiating with Apple to bring the iPhone to their network, and they have advanced LTE technology. So the reason this could come about now is that there, I guess, is a new chip from Qualcomm, the RF360 front-end solution chip, and this is a true world chip that supports all 2G, 3G, 4G LTE, and these new LTE advanced networks all on a single chip. It also apparently has support for the more obscure TD-SCDMA technology, which is the technology that's used by China Mobile, the largest mobile carrier in China, and the one carrier in China that's not supporting the iPhone currently. Apple would really, I think, like to get the iPhone on that network, but they haven't been able to do a deal yet, and a big part of being able to do that deal would be having a phone that's supported on the network technology that they're using. So if this is a true world chip and supports all of that, I think Apple would like the ability to just sell one phone to all of the carrier networks worldwide, and this might enable that, including the ability to support this new LTE advanced network. So I think if the chips are available and the prices work out, and there's a lot of ands in this, and they don't impact the battery life negatively on the iPhone, I don't know why Apple wouldn't use that chip and support the broadest range of wireless technologies that they possibly could. But those are some of the iPhone 5S rumors we've been hearing the past week. Moving on to the low-cost iPhone, we haven't been getting a lot more details about the low-cost iPhone. It's mostly been the same old kind of rumors that it's going to be a plastic case, so keeping costs down by not doing the metal enclosure like you have with the iPhone 5. As far as screen goes, it's expected to have exactly the same screen and form factor of the iPhone 5 screen, so a 4-inch Retina display. Apple's going to keep costs down in other ways. I would imagine it's going to have the same kinds of processors and be very similar to the current generation iPhone. But one thing we did see this week in leaked images was more details on the plastic case, and more specifically on the colors. A bunch of rear shells showed up in images, and they are red, green, yellow, and most recently we saw a couple more images that showed a blue version as well as a white version. And boy, am I glad there's a white version, because the colors, in my opinion, are what's a polite way to put it, fugly. They are not nice. To me, they look like they almost have this neon tone to them, at least from the images that I've seen. And if they are the colors, then I think Johnny Ive may have lost it. I don't know. I'd be curious to get your opinion. Maybe I'm overstating things. It's probably not fair to judge them without actually seeing them yet. But just based on the images online, it looks like maybe Johnny's been watching too many Miami Vice reruns on Netflix on his Apple TV. I don't know. I read in one blog post, you know, they were commenting on the colors, saying that they haven't been well received. And again, no guarantee these are the actual colors, right? These are leaked images on a phone that Apple hasn't even announced. So I know we're kind of overstepping our bounds here, but let's just assume that they are the colors. Well, one blog was postulating that they are being made ugly on purpose, that Apple is actually choosing colors that are not as pleasing as they could be, so that those folks who would normally buy a premium iPhone, an iPhone 5S or an iPhone 5, won't be swayed into the lower cost model. And I'm following their logic here. I don't believe this is how Apple would make a decision. Apple would never decide to make ugly color phones on purpose. I'm pretty certain of that. I think, you know, someone at Apple thinks these colors are a good choice, but I can see where the logic in this argument goes, because spec-wise, the new low-cost iPhone is going to be very similar to an iPhone 5 or a 4S, which, until this comes out, it is a premium product, right? The iPhone 5 is the current premium iPhone. And if the only difference is this one has a plastic case, then someone who might be looking at an iPhone 5S might go, well, you know, that's as good as my current iPhone 5, and it's only $99 or $199. I can save a lot of money by going to that model. But if you're the kind of shopper who wants the premium quality, the metal enclosure, and the design styling, maybe those ugly colors would be enough to dissuade you from buying one of them. I don't know. I just report on this stuff, people. I don't write it. So again, I'm not buying the argument, but I can see where their argument is coming from, right? And I'm actually starting to believe that these will be the colors that are actually coming out. As I was looking at them more and more, and as I was looking at screenshots and images of the new iOS 7, it seems like some of the colors in Apple's redesigned icons might be in the same palette as these new iPhone colors. They're a little bit bright. They almost seem primary, but again, to me, they seem to shift towards that neon, which I guess I don't follow fashion trends, or I don't know what's going on. Are we moving back to those 80s neon colors? I really hope not. But if we are, maybe the new low-cost iPhone will be perfectly in vogue and in style and become very, very popular. I think it's going to become popular regardless. I'm hoping Apple has made some better color choices. And I'm also hoping that, you know, there's some shifts in these images. If these are the actual colors, actually seeing them in the store and in person will make a difference. And very often it does. I remember thinking that the black on the iPhone, I probably even commented on it on the show, the black case on the iPhone 5 looked like it was going to look odd. And I certainly don't think that now, having owned one for a while. Finally, we also saw some leaked schematics, supposedly, on the next generation full-size iPad. This came from a French blog, and they seem to reveal at least some of the specifications for the next gen iPad. It looks like it's going to be about 15% thinner and possibly 33% lighter, while still sporting the same 9.7-inch display. Again, if the schematics can be believed. Very often we've seen case manufacturers say they have schematics for a new iPad and they turn out to be incorrect. But in this case, the images seem to coincide with some of the other rumors that we've been hearing. One way that Apple's able to make it a thinner, smaller device is by losing the wider bezel that's on the current generation models. matching more the design that they have in the iPad mini. And Apple actually tweaked the software in iOS so that you don't have those false touches on the side bezels. So they certainly could do that now with the next generation model. I don't think they're going to want to change the screen size or the aspect ratio. So this would be a good way to get a smaller device and still retain that same screen size. So that makes a lot of sense. It also has the iPad mini style curves on the back. So whereas the current fourth generation iPad has this gradual taper, it would be more of a rounded edge with a flat back, just like you have with the iPad mini. And all of the rumors to date have been indicating that Apple would go with an iPad mini design styling with the slate and black model and the silver and white models for the back case. So the back case looks almost identical to the iPad mini, and that adds some credibility to this set of schematics. The last thing we heard about this week in rumors for new Apple products was that Apple was filing for the iWatch trademark in a bunch of different places. Started out, we heard about Japan, I think, first, and also Russia earlier in the week. And then later in the week, we heard that Apple had put trademark filings in for the iWatch trademark in Taiwan, Mexico, and Turkey. Overall, to me, my reaction was meh. I mean, the rumors have been strong enough about an iWatch or a potential iWatch for long enough that we can be fairly certain it's something Apple is at least thinking about. And filing for trademarks on a term like iWatch could be simply a protection mechanism. As a matter of fact, Cook made some comments during the D conference that to Apple, he was asked by Walt Mossberg about what Apple thought about wearables, and basically said that the wrist was very interesting to him and Apple in terms of a product. So I originally wasn't thinking that we were going to see an iWatch, at least not anytime this year. I'm still kind of lukewarm on it. I don't think Apple's getting ready to put something out, but with these latest trademark filings, we are starting to hear more and more in the rumor mill that maybe Apple is getting ready to move forward on something. And certainly there is a lot of competition heating up in the market, and Apple probably, if they're going to do something, wants to get a product out sooner than later. I think we heard this week that Sunday, Best Buy might start selling the Pebble smartwatch. So if these products start getting out to consumers in a big way and start to take off in terms of popularity, Apple certainly would want to throw their hat into the ring. I just think it's going to happen probably in early 2014 and not before the holiday season this year. I think Apple just has too much stuff already to go, and they've really backweighted their product releases this year with the iPads and the iPhones. And certainly from a personal standpoint, my bank account can't handle all these Apple products coming out all at once. I just don't have the funds for that sort of thing, and I think a lot of people won't. So if Apple's going to just dump a whole ton of products all at once, especially for Apple fans, I think it's going to come down to having to decide really which product you want, and that could ultimately impact Apple's bottom line. So let's spread these things out a little bit more. I just don't think Apple's ready to release an iWatch. I think there's a lot of questions more on the usability side. It's not that technically they couldn't do it, but I think they really need to have that really good use case put in place before they would put out a product and try and compete in the market. Apple just doesn't throw something out to experiment with, or at least they don't do that in a big way. Occasionally, we'll get something like the Apple TV, where Apple is obviously playing around with something. I call it their public prototyping, but that's not historically how Apple runs things. So I think they're going to have more of a finished product and more of something where they can sell us a lifestyle or a use case with a wearable product. And I see that happening probably sometime next year. With Apple's new MacBook Airs and their Haswell processors hitting the marketplace, we've started to see performance and benchmarking sites putting the new Macs through their paces. And this past week, we've also seen what might be some pre-release benchmarks for Apple's redesigned Mac Pros, as well as potentially the new Haswell-based MacBook Pros. So the Mac Pro Apple gave a pre-release to, awesome-looking new machine with that new cylindrical design. It's teeny-tiny powerhouse, and Apple didn't you know, they released some generic marketing benchmarks saying, I think it has up to 2 times the performance of the current generation MacBook Pros or Mac Pros, excuse me. I'm going to mix those things up just so you know. Mac Pros, but they didn't give a lot of specifics, but reportedly some benchmarks are showing up at specifically Geekbench that might give an indication as to what we could see. Again, pre-release numbers, so we got to take them. Well, pre-release numbers and unofficial pre-release numbers, so we have to take them with a grain of salt. These sorts of things can be spoofed. But also, supposedly, Haswell-based MacBook Pros, something that many people are expecting Apple to update as well, especially now that we have new Haswell-based MacBook Airs. But any of the numbers on a pre-released or unannounced system need to be taken with a huge, huge grain of salt. But if they are accurate, something odd is that the new numbers don't seem to indicate the same kinds of speed boosts that Apple was claiming in their WWDC keynote slides. Specifically on those Geekbench numbers for the Mac Pro, they show just about a 10% increase in raw CPU performance. The unit that was spec'd out or reportedly showing up on Geekbench seems to be a 12-core 2.7 gigahertz Xeon E5-2697 processor that would be from the upcoming Ivy Bridge E family and running a special build of macOS 10 Mavericks with 64 gigabytes of RAM. So if those are the actual specs, it scored a 23,901 on its Geekbench score. That's only about 2,000 points higher than the current generation 2010 Westmere-based Mac Pro that would be running 12 cores, I would assume, with the same amount of RAM. And there are specific tests. So that's the overall Geekbench score. Geekbench also has specific tests that are listed. And in some areas, there is significant performance gains, much larger than in the overall score itself. Things like the integer and floating point areas, as well as image decompression. So we don't know where these numbers are coming from. We don't even know that it is actually a Mac Pro because you can kind of spoof some of the information that gets sent over to Geekbench. So it could be someone messing around. But John Poole over at Primate Labs commented on the leaked numbers and the seemingly odd performance for Mac rumors. He said he was expecting to see Geekbench scores for the Mac Pro as high as 30,000, if not 40,000. And he postulated as to what might be going on. He said, one, you know, it's pre-release hardware, so the hardware, firmware, and software might not be fully tweaked. There could be issues, things that are impacting and lowering the overall score. He also commented on the fact that the newer processors are clocked at a lower speed, and part of the reason for that may be that as you pack more cores into a single processor, this is, supposedly a single 12-core processor, you generally need to reduce the clock frequency, which is going to bring your numbers down a little bit. And then also, and this is, I think, the most important point and why we might be seeing lower numbers, is that software currently isn't optimized for the new Ivy Bridge Xeon processor. So while on paper, in theory, the new Xeon processor should be able to process about twice the amount of data as the current generation Westmere Xeons that Apple's using, and may very well be why in their slide at WWDC they threw that up as a spec. You need newer software, and you need software to be tweaked before it's going to be able to realize and see that full potential. So bottom line on all of this is for the Mac Pro, it's probably really, really too early to judge the numbers. The other thing that Poole pointed out in his piece for Mac Rumors was that, you know, you've got a 10% increase in a machine. So if these numbers turn out to be accurate, you get a 10% speed bump in a machine that's 1/8 the size of the current generation Mac Pro. But I think because we've been waiting for so long, a lot of people are really hoping that the Mac Pro sees a significant performance jump and increase over the current, you know, 3-year-old 2010 generation models. A 13-inch MacBook Pro, also reportedly with a Haswell chip, showed up on Geekbench as well. It was running a dual-core Intel Core i5 processor at 2.4 gigahertz with 8 gigabytes of RAM, according to its specs. It was not clear whether it was a Retina or a non-Retina display, but it also did seem to be running a special build of Mac OS X Mavericks. And in its numbers, it showed about a 5 to 8% improvement over the current generation 13-inch MacBook Pro. And while that doesn't seem like a huge jump, again, the key to remember with what Apple is doing with its Haswell processors, or seems to be, if what they've done with the MacBook Air is any indication, what they're doing with the Haswells on their notebooks and their mobile Macs is they seem to be focusing on battery life and really significantly increasing the battery life. So we're not expected with the MacBook Pros to get the same kind of increase, the 80% battery performance increase that we saw on the 13-inch MacBook Air, but I think we will see significant increases in battery life with the MacBook Pro. Apple has to do some trade-offs with the Retina displays. Probably one of the reasons why the MacBook Airs did not get a Retina display update was so that Apple could get to that 12 hours of battery life. And that is a lot more battery life than a lot of Apple's competition. And in case you don't think battery life matters too much, Ben Beharin over at Tech Opinions wrote a piece, and he says, you're wrong. You know, battery life could be even more important than increasing the processor performance. For most users these days, you know, except those really pro high-end power users, most of the applications you run pretty well and give you pretty good performance. And now that we're adding SSD and solid state drives, we're getting rid of some of the bottlenecks and read-write operations. For, I think, most consumers, their Macs and PCs are running perfectly fine. You're not typically hearing people say, well, this is way too slow. But what we do hear a lot about, and as people get used to the battery life on smartphones and tablets, is that we want computers that last all day. You want that all-day battery life out of your notebook. And when Beharin looked at the top four non-Apple notebooks for battery life on Amazon, he found that most of them fell in the probably 4 to 6 hour range. As a matter of fact, it was only the 11.6-inch Samsung Chromebook that had a 6.5-hour battery life. And I think all of Apple's current laptops, even their power books, have longer battery life out of the box than that. And with the new 13-inch MacBook Air, Apple is claiming up to 12 hours of battery life. And early tests from a lot of different sources seem to show them actually exceeding that time frame in real-world usage. So this is real-world 12-hour battery life. A lot of the competitive laptops that Apple's going up against, they'll have a theoretical 5-hour battery life, but really most users are getting in the 2 to 3 hour range. So if Apple can jump up the MacBook Pros to 7, 8, 9 hours of real world battery life, that is a pretty big deal, and I think will woo over a number of consumers. So that's what's happening on the performance side. You know, I think we're seeing Apple recognizing that doing some trade-offs with things like Retina displays or clocking down processors or going with more power-efficient processors, even if it doesn't give you that huge jump generation to generation in terms of raw CPU performance, Apple seems to be betting that most consumers are not going to worry about that spec too much, and that battery life is a spec that they want to focus on moving forward. And that's certainly the case if the 2013 MacBook Air is any indication. I mean, 12-hour all-day battery life is an amazing thing. But, you know, it's not so amazing if you can't get online. And there are reports from some new MacBook Air owners that they can connect to Wi-Fi, but eventually their connections seem to be failing, and it requires a full reboot to get the machines connected again. So not the best experience. I don't know how widespread this is. I think one of the sources I was reading about for this story indicated that there were thousands of posts on Apple's support website. The issue seems to be big enough that even Apple has taken notice. More on that in a second. But as to what's happening, the common theory is that it's something related to the new 802.11ac chipset that is in the updated MacBook Air. It doesn't seem to matter which kind of Wi-Fi routing equipment you have. So it's happening to people that have Apple routers as well as third-party routers. And it's not clear whether or not it's the hardware, the actual chipsets that are in the new MacBook Airs, or if it's something that can be addressed in software. Apple is reportedly offering some customers new machines, and they are sending in the affected models, the ones that they've been receiving that reportedly are defective in for analysis. So they are, I guess, looking into it. Another indication that they're trying to figure out what's going on is the last Friday, they reportedly started inviting some of the customers who are being impacted by this issue to take part in what's called an Apple Seed program, sending them a pre-release patch for the MacBook Air. A couple customers reported getting a patch from Apple called the MacBook Air Wi-Fi Update 1.0. Again, this is going through this special Seed program, and the email didn't specifically indicate what was addressed or what the update was set to address, but I think there's probably no stretch of the imagination to indicate that what they're trying to do is figure out what's going on with this 802.11 AC Wi-Fi bug. Beyond the bug, we're also starting to hear some indications about the 802.11 AC Wi-Fi performance. It's called Gigabit Wi-Fi, and it has some pretty impressive specifications in terms of theoretical maximum throughput. It's supposed to be able to transfer up to 866 megabits per second. That's about 108.25 megabytes per second of data. And you would think that if you're an owner of a new MacBook Air, you'd be able to get close to that. But Ars Technica found some indication that there might be some software limitations in macOS 10 preventing you from realizing that full speed potential on a new MacBook Air. What they found during their tests of a 2013 MacBook Air was that it was 41.3% faster to transfer files over SMB and 33.6% faster to transfer files over Apple's file sharing protocol, but that's nowhere near the almost over 200% increase that you should be able to see when moving from 802.11n to 802.11ac. And a Nantech was doing some testing, and their results ended up being very similar to what Ars Technica found. They got 21.2 megabytes per second data transfer, or about 169, almost 170 megabits per second across their connection, and that was the best they could do. That's a far cry from 866 megabits per second, right? What's that, about a fourth, about 200 megabits per second? Actually less than a quarter of the theoretical maximum. As to what's going on, they did some digging, and it turns out that the operating system could be the thing that is actually choking the data transfers across the 802.11ac connection. In essence, they say what's happening is it has something to do with a thing called TCP window sizing. And TCP window sizing defines the amount of data that a server can send before the client has to acknowledge that the data has been received. And in OS X, the current iterations, both OS X, 10.8, and even on Mavericks, what's happening is Apple is limiting that window size to 64 kilobytes. According to a Nantech, scaling the TCP window size up to 256 kilobytes would be the optimum window size for an 802.11 AC speed transfer. Now, the good news here is that it does seem to be a problem in software in the Wi-Fi networking stack. So Apple certainly could address it, but apparently hasn't, even in the latest, as I mentioned, in the latest builds of OS X Mavericks. Ours was able to verify that actually the MacBook Air and the new AirPort Extreme running Windows 8 could get a data transfer of 47.26 megabytes per second over the 802.11 AC connection. That does get pretty close to what you would expect. As a matter of fact, they say it's a 258% increase over the 2012 MacBook Air. So hopefully and probably Apple has a fix coming sometime soon to get past that limitation and allow us to realize the full potential of that new high-speed Wi-Fi connection. And I guess we haven't really talked about the new updated version of iOS 7. iOS Beta 2 was released, I think, a little over a week ago. It was the build that brought iOS 7 to developer's iPad, so they're playing around with it on that, and we're starting to get some leaks and information about some of the new features that are built into the latest version of the beta. Siri now has her and actually his new voice. There's a new male voice in Siri that is more natural and also a more natural female voice. You can actually switch between them in the settings on your iOS device now. And according to 9to5Mac, you can even help Siri with her pronunciation. I guess if Siri doesn't recognize a name, she will actually ask you to clarify the pronunciation, play back a couple different versions, and allow you to pick which one to use. I guess that's a new system Apple can use to actually improve the quality of Siri. And the UI gives you a couple different options to check. And also, according to the article, you can reportedly say something like, that's not how you pronounce, and then any name that Siri is mispronouncing, it'll actually bring up the interface and allow you to make her, or again, him, a little bit smarter. There's also some new image detectors that will reportedly allow you to locate facial expressions, or allow developers, rather, to locate facial expressions within photos. According to the reports, there are specific functions that can detect things like whether or not a person is blinking or smiling in a photo. This sounds pretty cool to me, because I would imagine it would allow you to do something in an app like grab a rapid series of snapshots and then use those functions to detect which images in that series have the best facial expressions, and then merge those together. So you could merge facial expressions from a series or a couple different photos, or it could just automatically select the best image and then only save that one. So you get the best shots, at least in terms of people's faces, every time. And then we also heard this past week about a new accessibility option that's built into iOS 7. I don't know if this was in the first build as well, but we're just getting information on it as well. And it's the ability to add settings for switches. So I think this is things like, there are a number of accessibility devices for people who have limited mobility, so that they can use different devices and switches to control electronics. These would be things like head switches, or I would imagine foot pedals or elbow pedals or little paddles and things like that, that might be hooked up to, say, a wheelchair or an environment someone's working in. And apparently with these switches, you can also now use the FaceTime camera on your iPhone to detect head movements. So you can assign switches to the left and right head movements that'll be detected by your camera, and you can map those to different functions, say like a tap or a pressing on the home button or something like that. As a matter of fact, I think 9to5Mac did a video showing off how this works, and it's pretty cool. So once you've turned it on and enabled it in the accessibility settings, if you simply turn your head to the left or turn your head to the right, it will trigger one of these switches. It's a little bit cumbersome in terms of the control, because the way it works is it, as you're on a screen, highlights and moves through almost slideshow-like the different elements, and then when it lands, when the highlighting and selection lands on a particular item that you want to activate with the switch, with the head movement, then you move your head at that point. So imagine you're on your home screen and you're trying to launch an application. What it'll do is it'll start highlighting the icons, and then if you've mapped a head movement to a tap gesture, you can make that head movement when it reaches that icon, and it will launch that application, and then it'll begin cycling through the interface elements that are within that application, and you can start to tap on and select those things. So cool little bit of technology, and really Apple expanding their accessibility. I think they have such a huge lead over any other device when it comes to accessibility that they're doing amazing things, and they really need to be applauded for that. I'm actually have a request from someone to get Josh DeLioncourt back on the MacCast to give us an update on some of the new accessibility features that are built both into the current generation of Mac OS X, or of iOS and Mac OS X, I guess, and also the newer versions. We'll probably wait until Mavericks and iOS 7 are officially released before we have him back on, because I'd like to know about all the new kind of cool things that are built in there. But stay tuned for that. Now, I have a trio of stories related to iTunes, starting with Horace Dedu over at Asimco. He did some cool number crunching on Apple's TV show and music downloads and concluded some pretty amazing statistics. According to his figures, he says that Apple's iTunes rakes in about $6.9 billion a year, which accounts for roughly 75% of all digital music sales. The way he did the calculations was he used some numbers from Billboard, who says the average iTunes account holder spends about $12 a year on music. And then he combined that with some numbers from All Things D that Apple currently has about 575 million active users and was able to put those together and then compare those against industry sales numbers to make his deductions. 20% of iTunes store users reportedly lost access to making purchases and downloads for about 20 minutes last week. So if you happen to be trying to make a purchase and ran into some issues, that was what was going on. The outage wasn't long, but it did reportedly, according to Mac and N, impact a larger percentage of customers than most outages do for Apple. The customers experiencing the outages also lost access to the App Store and the iBook Store as well. All those things are tied together. And earlier that same day, for about 45 minutes, iCloud also had an outage, roughly impacting 1.5% of Apple's customers. And that's typically more what we see in the outages, somewhere in the 1-2% range. There was no reason given for why the outages happened, but you know, these sorts of things happen all the time. As a matter of fact, Apple has a whole iCloud status page that you can look up and see whether or not they're currently experiencing an outage. So if you've ever run into issues and problems and want to know if it's Apple or you, that page can be actually particularly helpful. And then before Apple announced iTunes Radio at WWDC, one of the reported challenges that they were supposedly having was reaching deals with the labels. They were, according to reports, having disagreements over streaming royalty rates and ad revenue share percentages. Most of the reports were indicating that Apple wanted to get lower rates than the industry was offering Pandora. But now the Wall Street Journal says that they have details on exactly what Apple is paying for iTunes Radio, and it looks like it might be more than Pandora. According to the journal, during the first year of iTunes Radio operation, Apple is going to pay the labels 13 cents each time a song gets played, as well as offering them 15% of net advertising revenues, and that's going to be proportionate to a label's given share of the music played on the iTunes Radio service. Apple also will pay more in the second year of the service, according to the journal. In the second year, those numbers jump up to 14 cents per listen and a revenue share of 19% of the net advertising. Apple also supposedly has some interesting exceptions built into the new deal. They supposedly are not going to have to pay royalties on songs that users already have in their iTunes library, and that would include songs on a album that a listener might just have one or two tracks from. So that should save them a little bit of money in terms of the royalty rates. And another area where they will reportedly save on royalties is that, according to the journal, they do not have to pay royalties on songs that are skipped before the 22nd mark, and also on any songs that are currently included in a promotion. So Apple has, while they might be paying a little bit more in the per song royalty rate, they do have some areas where they can save a little bit. It'll be interesting to see how those two combine together and if they end up net getting a better deal than what the radio industry is giving Pandora. The caveat on the skipping thing, though, is that Apple only gets to skip paying royalties on two songs per user per hour. So you can, how they're going to keep track of all that stuff with the, I'll imagine billions and billions of streams that they're going to be doing. You know, I guess we have computers to handle this stuff, but man, it seems really complicated and probably why these deals are so hard to push through. And you know, we're just talking about what Apple has worked out in terms of a deal with the labels. There's a lot of controversy right now overall about how much the actual artists make from streaming royalties, and the fact that Apple and companies like Pandora and Google Music and anybody who wants to offer a streaming or a catalog music service, you know, they obviously want to get the best deal, but that doesn't always necessarily mean that the artists and the creators of this content are getting a good deal. As a matter of fact, most of the time, they're pretty much getting shafted. The industry has not been set up that way. So I'm hoping that as services like iTunes Radio and more of these catalog services come out and artists are able to go more direct and skip the labels, that things will get better. But for now, this is the system that's kind of in place and everybody's kind of having to play by this game. But for Apple's part, I guess they are paying just a little bit more than Pandora does currently. Comscore released the latest U.S. smartphone share numbers, and they showed that Apple actually increased their smartphone share for the month of May. According to the report, Apple increased their share from February up 0.3%, coming in at 39.2%. Samsung was also able to increase their U.S. smartphone market share. They were up 1.7%, so a bit more than Apple, and they were likely helped by the launch of a new phone. They had the Galaxy S4, which was extremely popular. Their total share, though, ended up being 23%, well below Apple's 39.2% share. HTC, Motorola, and LG also all saw their market share slip a little bit, so everybody's sort of losing market share in the U.S. against Apple and Samsung. As a matter of fact, together, Apple and Samsung now account for more than 60% of the U.S. smartphone market, and their combined profit share actually comes in at 100%. So they make all of the money and sell 60% of the smartphones in the U.S. Overall, in operating systems, Android still has a lead over iOS. They grabbed a 52% share of the overall U.S. market. And I guess maybe looking to increase their iPhone numbers a little bit more, at least among students, Apple announced this year's Apple Back to School promotion. And for the first time ever, if you buy an iPhone, you can actually qualify for the credit. What Apple does is with the purchase of a new Mac or Apple product, you receive an iTunes App Store gift card worth either $50 or $100. In the past, iPhones were excluded from the promotion, but they will qualify this year. So if you are a student and you purchase an iPhone or an iPod, you will receive a $50 iTunes App Store gift card, and you get a $100 gift card with the purchase of a new Mac. I have three quick stories for you in international Apple news this week. The iPad mini finally went on sale in Brazil last week. Pricing starts at 1,299 Brazilian real for the 16-gigabyte iPad mini. That's approximately $583 US, well over the $329 price we would pay here. So I guess the news is a little bit bittersweet, although it's my understanding that Apple products in Brazil are always at a price premium. As a matter of fact, I know there's many areas of the world that pay a price premium for Apple products. I wish things were a little bit more equal. You know, there's all kinds of extraneous factors that go into this sort of thing. I guess if you live in one of those countries, you're somewhat used to it, but I think it still doesn't take the sting out of the high price tag, especially for us Apple fans. Also, last week, Apple finally launched a version of its official online store for customers in Russia. Now, customers in Russia can finally order Apple products directly from Apple online. Apple still doesn't have any physical retail locations in the region, but rumors are circling that Apple might be looking into space in some parts of Russia, so that could happen hopefully sometime in the next year or so. Apple also brought the iTunes store to Russia late last year, so I guess you Russian Apple fans are a little bit late to the party, but at least Apple continues to expand over in your part of the world. We also had another story about Apple's, how should we call it, creative corporate tax strategies this time around over in the UK, and it came via the Financial Times, who says that despite reporting profits of about £68 million, about $103 million US, in the UK, Apple paid no UK corporate taxes in 2012. Apparently, Apple has three main British subsidiaries, Apple UK, Apple Europe, and Apple Retail UK. It looks like what they did was use a legitimate UK tax deduction where they can take shares awarded to employees and use those to wipe out their corporate tax liability in the region. So not doing anything illegal, but certainly given the fact that a lot of questions have been raised about Apple's corporate tax tactics in the US and Ireland, I think that the UK government will likely be taking a look at what Apple's doing over there a little bit more closely and just confirming that Apple's doing everything above board. I'm sure they actually are, but it may also cause some of these countries to, like the US is doing, look at and reevaluate some of the corporate tax deductions that they offer companies. And then finally, in France, Apple's offices were reportedly raided by French authorities. They were looking to gather evidence in an antitrust case. I guess what's going on is Apple is being accused of engaging in anti-competitive practices specifically related to their retail operations. Some of the independent retailers in the region claim that Apple is violating their existing agreements by favoring their stores when it comes to stock and availability on new products. I'm actually, frankly, not surprised to hear this. I've heard similar complaints from independent resellers here in the U.S. that when it comes to getting new products, there's all kinds of restrictions and weird rules and regulations regarding actually getting new Apple products and being able to stock them, and that Apple really does seem to give, or has it, they have the impression that Apple is giving preferential treatment to stock and availability on their own retail stores. Seems to make logical sense, but I guess in France, where there's some consumer protection laws, and I'm sure in other areas, the U.S. included, there's going to be a little bit of scrutiny into some of those practices. And in this case, the authorities felt it was warranted to go in and actually raid some of Apple's offices, wholesalers, and retail locations. And I guess in some ways this next story also qualifies as an international story, but reportedly Apple and Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing have reached an agreement for chip manufacturing. It's probably not going to be happening this year, though. The Wall Street Journal cites an executive source at TSMC who says they reached a deal with Apple for A-series chip manufacturing to start in 2014. Seemingly, this backs up years and years of rumors that we've been hearing that Apple has been working on a deal, as the story says that the deal has been, quote-unquote, years in the making, probably why we have been talking about this for so long. The main hang-up, I guess, was TSMC's ability to meet the production requirements and standards that were demanded by Apple. The company has supposedly sorted out all of those technical difficulties and with manufacturing, and we'll be rolling out the next generation 20 nanometer based A-series chips destined for Apple's 2014 products. The belief is that TSMC chips will be the Apple A8 series, or start with the A8 series. It's not expected to be a complete move away from Samsung as a chip supplier, at least at first, but it's expected that the deal will allow Apple to continue to significantly reduce its dependence on Samsung as a component supplier starting in 2014. Apple continues its expansion of its data center operations outside of their first data center in North Carolina. We know they're building facilities in, I think, Oregon as well as Reno, and they continue the trend to support those operations with completely green energy. According to GigaOhm, Apple is working with NV Energy in Reno to build a new 137-acre solar farm near its Reno data center operation. The farm will be similar in size to the two farms Apple has built in Maiden, North Carolina, which are the biggest private solar farms in the U.S., I think. I don't know if this is going to be bigger. It sounds like it's going to be similar in size. They also, like the North Carolina farms, are expected to output about 18 to 20 megawatts of power, but with the Nevada farm, they're actually adding some new technology to the operation. This time around, in addition to just the solar panels, it's going to employ a mirror system that will allow it to focus the sun's rays onto the panels. Apple is, I guess, working again with Sun Power to help engineer the system and build the solar farm in Nevada. That's the same company they worked with on the North Carolina farms as well. And Apple is funding the build with a new green tariff that was introduced in Nevada this year. With that, it could allow the state to actually use or buy the solar farm from Apple at some point in the future. In a statement about the new facility, Apple said that the solar array will generate approximately 43.5 million kilowatt hours of clean energy, and that would be the equivalent to taking 6,400 passenger vehicles off the road per year. And then finally, in the news for this week, there was a security update released for macOS 10 Lion and Mountain Lion. In its update, Apple simply stated that it's recommended for all users and improves security of macOS 10. The release documents, though, indicate that the patch updates three vulnerabilities inside QuickTime where buffer overflows or underflows could be used in certain situations to cause unexpected application termination or arbitrary code execution. You can get the update by running software update from the Mac App Store, System Preferences, or going to apple.com/support. And with that, that'll do it for the news for this week. Before I move on, I want to take another quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, Squarespace, if you need to build a website and you're not a web programmer, you don't want to hire a web programmer, or even if you are a web programmer, you probably want to check it out. It is an awesome platform for building websites. And I say that being a web developer myself. They have a intuitive, easy-to-use platform that really lets anybody create a really professional-looking website. You can do a blog, you can do a gallery, you can even do e-commerce, and they do it all on a single platform. You can sell digital goods, you can sell physical stuff. Doesn't really matter. They make it really easy to get up and get going. They have these amazing templates that are built by a design team. They're being constantly updated. They're all original designs for the Squarespace platform. And you can fully customize them. You can tweak all kinds of things within them, add all kinds of widgets and put functionality in. So if you need social, you just drop it in. If you need email forms, you just drop them in. It could not be simpler. They really make it easy and fun. It's a fun to use platform as well. You'll just get in there and you'll want to tweak things. You'll want to play around with your images and your text, and you can just drag and drop. It's a really great interface. And if you get stuck, they have great support. It's more than just hosting the website. They give you analytics. They have a support team to help you set things up 24/7. You can email them and ask questions. And you can even, when you sign up for a year, get a free domain name. So they handle domain name registration. It's everything all in one package. And you can try it completely free, no credit card required. All you have to do is go to squarespace.com and sign up. And when you make your purchase, you make sure to use the offer code MACCAST6 and you'll get 10% off any new account. So that's squarespace.com to try out the free trial. And when you make your purchase, use the offer code MACCAST6 to save 10%. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. About a week ago or so, Apple issued a Java update for macOS 10, and I use Java because I use CrashPlan and it has a Java client, so I typically will try and update right away if Apple pushes out a Java update, but as it turned out this time, it was somewhat of a bad thing, well, not a hugely bad thing, but the update apparently introduced a new bug that could cause some Java applications to actually stop working. Now, the good news is that Apple quickly figured it out and they issued a patch. The bad news is that if you're like me, one of the people who already grabbed the update, it doesn't notify you, nor does the system actually go in and patch itself. So you have no way of really knowing that you got the bad version unless you go in and either check it with a terminal command or just, you know, actually reapply a new version of the patch. So you can, and I'll have instructions for this in the show notes at maccast.com. You can run this little command in your terminal to check the version of Java that was installed. But if you grabbed the Java for OS 10 2013-004 update or the Java for Mac OS 10.6 update 16, you'll probably want to check to see if you have the correct latest and greatest version. What you do is you run this little command in the terminal, and then in the results that come up, you want to look for a specific version number. If it has the numbers XM, or alphanumeric letters, I guess, if it has the alphanumerics XM4509 on the end, then I guess you're good to go. But if it says, like it did in my case, XM4508, then you need to run the Java update again, and you can grab it from Apple's support website and reinstall it. I guess if you really don't want to bother with the terminal command, if you think that you just may have picked up the wrong version, you could just go download the software and rerun it. It's not going to harm anything to just simply reapply it. If you have the wrong version, it'll go ahead and update it and you're good to go. But I kind of was curious about it and wanted to know, so I ran the little terminal command to check it out. And again, I'll have that in the show notes if you want to do that on your own system. I've had Apple paid iTunes Music Match service and iTunes in the cloud for how long has it been out? About a year? Has it been that long? I can't really remember. I got it the minute that it came out. The minute it was released and available, I spent my $25 a year to actually have access to the service. And the reason is that I wanted to not have to sync my music anymore. I loved the idea of being able to access my entire music library via streaming on my phone and my iPad and all my devices without having to actually go in and manage music. And more as my devices were getting fuller, I was finding I was having to manage my music and my movies and stuff like that more frequently. So to not have to do that with songs just sounded like a deal to me. $25 a year was well worth it. It's a little bit trickier on my iPad than on my iPhone, though, because my iPad is a Wi-Fi only iPad, which means that if I'm out and about and I don't have access to an open Wi-Fi connection, then I'm sort of out of luck. Now, luckily, I got rid of my unlimited data plan on my iPhone, and I can now tether with that, but I prefer not to do that. And I've had several of you ask me about iTunes Match, and specifically, how do you manage it when you don't have access to a live internet connection? So if you don't have cellular data, you only have Wi-Fi, you know, or maybe you're getting on a plane going into airplane mode, what if you want to still have access to your music? How does that whole process work? So I thought I'd cover some of the ways you can do that, and it actually works out surprisingly well. Once you've enabled iTunes Match on your device, the first thing you need to know is that you can no longer manage the music from within iTunes. So if you connect your device, go into iTunes, and go to the Music tab, you'll see it'll tell you you're on iTunes Music Match, you have it enabled, and that you need to manage it from the device. For those of you who don't know how to turn on Music Match, or iTunes Match, excuse me, you go into the settings on your device under the music settings, and there's just a little toggle switch. You toggle iTunes Music Match on, and of course you have to pay for the service or subscribe to the service to use the iTunes music or iTunes Match features. When browsing then your music on your device, what you'll notice once iTunes Match has been turned on is that there is a little cloud icon that appears next to any track that is stored up in iTunes in the cloud, but not stored locally on the device. You can simply tap on the track to actually play it as a stream. So if you have internet connection, cellular or Wi-Fi, you just hit your music and it'll just start streaming. It doesn't download it, and we'll get into the technicalities of that because it actually does download it, but you know, it'll just start playing after a second or two. If you tap the little cloud icon though next to it, it'll actually download the track and then store that locally on the device and make it accessible, and then the little icon will go away. And so that is actually how you can pull music down and actually have it stored on the device locally. You just go to the track, tap the little cloud icon, and now you've pulled it down. You've synced it, quote unquote, or downloaded it to your device. And you can actually go in and download whole entire albums or entire catalogs from certain artists or even your playlists as well. For that, you just go in, find them in your music library on your device, and then you'll notice there's a download all button that you can click on to pull down all of those tracks. Now, I mentioned that when you stream, you're also technically downloading. It actually does a progressive download. So it starts to download the file, and the minute that it has enough to play with a good buffer, it'll start allowing, you know, it'll just simply start playing that track, and it downloads it in the background. The main difference between how it downloads that way versus clicking on the little cloud icon is that it doesn't indicate in your music library that that is stored locally. You'll still have the iCloud icon, and you could still click on it and technically download it again. I'm actually curious if you've already downloaded it in the background. I'm not really sure if it would re-download it from iTunes and overwrite the local copy that you already have, or if it'll just simply, you know, change the little bit that tells it, hey, this is actually here and stored locally on this device. I'm not exactly sure how that works. But the point is that when you're in airplane mode, or you don't have a Wi-Fi or cellular connection, the music app is actually smart enough to recognize that it can't go out to the cloud, and it will change the display of your music library to only show you the music files that are stored and downloaded on the device. And those are the ones whether you implicitly downloaded them by clicking the little icon, or even the ones that had streamed down. So if you're like me and you listen to your music on shuffle a lot, I just, you know, shuffle it in my car, so it's constantly pulling down music and storing it in the background. When I go into airplane mode and then look at my music library, I see all of those tracks that had been played just as I was doing the whole shuffle thing. You can also manually force your music app to show you just those tracks by going into the settings on your iOS device under music and toggling off the show all music option. When that is turned on, it'll actually show you your iTunes and the cloud music along with the locally stored stuff. Turning that off, you just see the stuff that is stored locally. And so that is kind of how it works. You can also, you know, turn off Music Match and then through iTunes sync music directly to your device if you want to load a bunch of stuff on quickly, because it's my understanding that when you do that and then you re-enable the Music Match service, it won't remove the tracks that you've already synced over to your device. Like, it doesn't go in and immediately delete that stuff. It'll leave that stuff there as long as there's room. And that's the other important thing to know. For the tracks that actually you don't implicitly download, so the stuff that just downloads in the background when you're actually streaming, that'll stay on your device and use up your storage space until some other app needs that space. And then those files are allowed to be automatically purged. So you can't just go in and sort of, through listening to music via the streaming options with Match, eat up all the storage space on your device. It actually gives priority to other applications when it comes to that storage space, which I guess is why it doesn't just show up as having been downloaded in your library, because technically, you know, it's back to the thing, while it's stored locally on the device, technically it's not quote-unquote downloaded and available for you to just have anytime, anywhere, unless you implicitly actually download the track. So that's how that works, and it works quite well. So if you were going to go get on a plane and you wanted an album, you need to make sure before you get on the plane that you go in and use those download options to grab your music. Another thing related to iTunes Match, a little interesting loophole that Jason emailed me about, has to do with pre-ordering music through the iTunes Store, or more correctly or more accurately, through ordering a physical disc. Jason had a new album from one of his favorite artists that was coming out. It was available for pre-order on iTunes, but he decided to opt for pre-ordering the physical disc because he says, and I don't buy a lot of pre-release music, but he says oftentimes you will get the shipment of the physical disc before the actual release date on iTunes. And so he wanted to get the album as soon as he possibly could. And it turned out he did get it a week earlier than it was due to launch on iTunes. But to his surprise, he has iTunes Match. He ripped the album into his library and then did the iTunes Match on it. And it actually found and matched the copy that was up there in iTunes. And it was not the case where, you know, with iTunes Match, if you have music that's not in Apple's catalog, it'll actually upload that to your iCloud account. It didn't do that. This was actually showing that it was matched with the iTunes version. And as a matter of fact, Jason said he could even click on the download option and it pulled down Apple's 256 kilobit per second AAC version of the file for him. So it was already loaded in Apple's library, probably in anticipation of the actual release date, but you just couldn't access it directly from making the purchase on iTunes. So if you're the type of person who loves pre-ordered music, you might play around with this trick, and it could enable you to get access to iTunes Match copies a little bit earlier than the actual release date. And then Fernando also had a question about matching music through iTunes Match, specifically related to the local storage on his Mac. And I've had a few people also ask me this question. And the question is if I turn on Music Match and I have it go through and match all of the tracks in my library, can I go ahead and delete any of the matched tracks from my Mac locally and just listen to them through the iTunes Match service, streaming them from the cloud? And this is a tricky answer, because technically, yes, you can do that. I wouldn't recommend it, and I don't do it on my own system. And if you do, you do want to make sure that before you try it, you back up any and all local copies you have of your music. That's both stuff that you've ripped yourself and your purchase content. Make sure you have good multiple backups of that, and you have it stored someplace. So it's not really going to free you up from having to back that stuff up. It could free you up from having to store it locally on your internal drive on your Mac, say, because what happens is once you delete it from the iTunes interface, yes, you could go and re-download it through the iTunes Match cloud service and bring it back in, but Apple doesn't always have that stuff available, and they don't guarantee that they have backups or copies or things like that. So you still have to take on that responsibility yourself. And the way this works is, if you've ever had iTunes Match or used iTunes in the cloud, once it's been matched and uploaded, if you go to delete that track from your iTunes library, and you'll want to do this from the iTunes interface, because when you select that track and you hit delete, it'll ask you if you want to remove the file and move it to the trash, but it'll also ask you if you want to keep the copy that is in iTunes in the cloud. And for that, you're going to, of course, want to say yes. So you'll delete the local copy and leave the iTunes cloud version. Don't delete it from the cloud. So I can't remember if the answer is yes or no. I think you need to say no. It'll say, do you want to remove this track from iTunes in the cloud? Say no. Read the language. I don't have the dialogue up in front of me. But the point is, you want to leave it in the cloud, delete the local copy. It'll actually just move the local copies to the trash, and then you can empty the trash again. Please, please make sure that you have local backups of this. I can't stress that enough. Because the reason is that very often iTunes, things on the iTunes side can change. Apple does not always have copies available in the cloud for you to re-download, because their licensing deals with the record labels come up for renewal, the terms change, labels drop on or off, independent artists may change their terms with Apple, they may not renew. So you could go to find you want to re-download it, something that you had in the cloud in the past, and suddenly it's not there. Or I've also had instances where they changed the version. So maybe what you ripped and put into your Mac was the explicit lyrics version, but Apple only carries the radio edit version. So you could end up with a different copy or a different version of your song. So you'll want to have that backup so you can go back and do it. But if you're really low and tight on space on your Mac and you want to try that, Fernando, you certainly can. Again, I don't really recommend it, because I think it's more hassle than it's actually worth and could cause more problems than it's actually worth. But a couple little tips and tricks related to iTunes Match for you this week. Now I have a backup question. You know, I'm huge on backup, and we talk about it quite frequently here on the MacCast. But usually when we're talking about backup, we're talking about backing up your main hard drive or maybe some external drives that are connected to your Mac. But specifically this week, I got this question from Matt.
Hey, Adam, it's Matt in Dallas, Texas. Just calling to ask your opinion on backup, and more specifically backup of a storage device that is not my Mac specifically. So my household, we've all moved to MacBook Airs, but one of the downsides of that is that my wife has gigabytes and gigabytes of photos that now can no longer be stored on her Air. So I was thinking about getting a network attached storage with two drives and doing backing her MacBook Air through Time Machine up to one of the drives, and additionally storing all of her photos on that, and then using RAID 1 to copy over to the second drive in that network attached storage and use that as my backup. But I've been reading a lot about how RAID is not actually a backup strategy. It's just a data downtime prevention strategy. So I was just trying to get your opinion on a way to have a great backup strategy and store a bunch of data that is not stored on an actual Mac computer in a sort of an easy way to do it within my home network. Keep up the great work. Love the show. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Matt, I will start by kind of addressing the whole NAS thing and more specifically the whole RAID 1 mirroring. So, you know, in your case, the way you would actually be using it, if you're going to be doing a time machine from the MacBook Air's hard drive over to the RAID system or the NAS RAID, then you're making a backup, right? You're making a backup copy of what's on the Mac and you're putting it onto a hard drive. As far as the RAID 1 mirroring goes, you're not necessarily, what people are responding to there is you're not creating a backup as much as you're creating redundancy within that backup so that if you have a hard drive failure, it's really RAID 1 is kind of addressing a single hard drive failure where the hard drive can go bad and you're not going to lose your data because you have two hard drives, each with its own copy of that data. The problem there when it comes to backup is that a lot of people, that's their only copy of their files. So they think, well, I'll just put my data onto this RAID 1 drive, and then I have a backup copy. And you can't think about it that way. A RAID 1 drive is really, you have to think of as a single drive. But if you're using that for the sole purpose of backup, then it is technically a backup. If it's your main drive, the drive that you're working off of, you just have a single copy of your file. Yes, it's spread across two drives, but if something goes wrong with that file, it has corruption, it goes bad, it's actually bad on both versions of the drive. It's not like a backup where if it's a timed backup, like Time Machine, where you can go back and get a copy of that file. So you just need to kind of think about it that way. In some ways, you know, it's kind of the same as a cloned backup. The bigger advantage of clone backups, though, is that there might be a time delay before you actually rewrite to that drive. With RAID 1 system, it's constantly writing your files and your documents as you're changing them to both drives, to both platters at the same time, keeping them in sync. With a clone backup, I run mine nightly, so if I had a corrupt file, if I discovered a corrupt file on my local system, I could go back to my super duper and potentially still recover that file as long as that update hasn't run. Drobo is sort of the same thing. I don't know if you looked into that, but it's more drives, right? It's still a RAID system, but in its case, it's redundant across multiple drives. The other advantage it brings is that you can use the extra storage of the additional drives, and you don't have to use all of that for redundancy. With like a RAID 1, it's literally a mirrored copy of both drives. But just like a RAID 1 solution, something like a Drobo doesn't recover you from those oops moments where you accidentally deleted something or you have data corruption. Once you've written to the Drobo, it's written across all the drives and you can't just, you know, get different versions of that stuff. So ultimately, when it comes to backup, whether it's local or NAS or whatever, really the strategy you want to employ is to have multiple copies and in multiple locations. That's what I do for my system. Now, I'm pretty fanatical about it, so I actually employ four different systems. I have a Time Machine backup that's locally connected to my Macs, but versioned, so I can get that case where, oops, I accidentally deleted that file, I want to go back and get that. Then I also have locally connected a super duper clone backup. So I have a second hard drive that just literally nightly clones my system. That's so I can do an emergency boot, get back up and running should I have a hardware failure. That's something that your RAID system would take care of, right? If you had a hard drive fail in your RAID, you could just pop in a new drive, it'll re-mirror, and you're back up and running and you haven't lost any data. Then I also have CrashPlan, which is my offsite backup. So my critical files and documents are set up to go through CrashPlan, through the internet, offsite. And another nice advantage of CrashPlan is it does keep versions of my documents. So like Time Machine, in certain instances, I can go back and get an earlier version of a document if I found corruption or had some sort of error. And then the last solution, which is probably the solution that I'm going to recommend for you if you want to use a NAS drive to do backups of, say, an iPhoto library, is I use a Drobo, but you could use any kind of network-attached storage device. I use a Drobo plus ChronoSync to actually copy over documents. And so then those are stored within my house locally on my Drobo. And I also use an archive option that's built into ChronoSync so that in most cases, any copies that I delete locally on my Mac of stuff that's been backed up to my Drobo via ChronoSync, I don't delete the copies on the Drobo. It's an option of ChronoSync, and it's kind of nice because it gives you that legacy. I can go back and grab a document that maybe I accidentally deleted. And I don't do that for all of my documents and files, but for certain things like stuff in my iTunes music library or certain other kinds of files, I definitely do that. My podcasts are a good example of that. So I can sync over nightly stuff that I keep for recordings for the Maccast in my local drive, and then if I ever want to delete them locally, I know that I've already created a ChronoSync backup to my Drobo and I have an extra copy of that file. So in your case, I would set up something like that. I would get the network attached storage device and then use software like ChronoSync to actually define files or different things that you want to back up from your local Macs to that system and then have them stored on your NAS drive, and then that'll give you that first layer of backup. And then, of course, you probably also want some sort of way to back up those files offsite. So whether you go through CrashPlan or however you manage that, you can do it. Now, you were specifically asking about drives and storage devices that aren't implicitly tied to or set up on your local Mac. There are actually some network-attached storage solutions that can back up offsite directly from the NAS to a service like CrashPlan. As a matter of fact, Synology, the Synology disk stations, actually have a little application that you can run headless because it hooks up to the internet, and you can actually have CrashPlan files and folders and documents and things backed up directly from the NAS drive to CrashPlan without having to use any kind of computer or Mac. So I would certainly recommend maybe looking into those solutions if you're looking for a network-attached storage solution. And the only other thing I'll mention on NAS drives, and specifically Time Machine, is that not all network-attached storage will work with Time Machine. So when you're evaluating solutions and looking for stuff to buy, make sure that you implicitly and specifically check for Time Machine support in your NAS solution. So I hope that information helps you out, and good luck with your backup solution. Now, Mark also emailed me. He has a similar dilemma, but it's a slightly different problem. In his case, what he wants to do is move his music library for iTunes off of his Mac, his iMac, and put that on an external drive. And we've covered doing that on the show. It's relatively easy to do. Apple has some pretty good instructions. As a matter of fact, that's how I run my iTunes music library. I have it on a external USB drive. But in Mark's case, he also wants to have a cloned backup of his Mac, something like SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner, but he wants to make sure that all of those media files that were moved off and put on another drive, not on his internal drive, are also being backed up as well. And then to add to all of this, he has limited budget and limited desktop space. So, Mark, you wanted to know, you know, what would I recommend as a solution for doing this? And as I already alluded to, I kind of exactly do the kind of thing that you're thinking about. I'll tell you how I handle it. I'm not necessarily saying this is the best solution, but it's a solution that's worked for me. So I have, a small 2.5-inch, 1 terabyte USB hard drive. I think this one's a Seagate, but, you know, you can check OWC or the different locations, Newegg, Amazon, whatever, for a good deal. Get a Western Digital or a Seagate or whatever brand you prefer. And then I moved my iTunes library to that drive. I actually use it for some other storage, but mainly it's my iTunes drive, and I set up iTunes to read from that. In addition, I also have a second 2.5-inch, 1 terabyte USB hard drive that I use as my super duper clone. So I have both of those hooked up to a hub that's connected to my Mac. The advantage of using the smaller 2.5-inch drives is that they don't take up a lot of space. They're bus powered, they're really tiny, so desk space for me isn't so much of an issue. I don't know how cramped you are, but you probably could get away with that sort of solution. And then for actually getting a backup of my iTunes media library, that's part of what I alluded to earlier, the ChronoSync backup. So I use ChronoSync running on my Mac to actually back up those files, the iTunes media files, nightly to my Drobo. So if there's any changes, anything happens, that stuff gets backed up automatically. And in my case, my Drobo is actually connected to an old Mac Mini that I have in another room. So I don't have to worry about desk space or anything related to that. And then both my Mac drive and my iTunes media drive on the external volume are also backed up with CrashPlan. So I have a third offsite version of my iTunes media folder also backed up, as well as, of course, my Time Machine. So I've got that four separate copies. You know, again, I'm fanatical about this stuff, but you make sure you have at least two copies. Three copies is probably a good idea as well for your really critical documents. And the backup drive doesn't have to necessarily be a Drobo. It could be a two-bay NAS drive. It could be a single network attached storage drive. It could even be the internal drive on an old Mac. I could have just used the Mac Mini drive and done my ChronoSync backup across my network to that, since really all that Mac Mini does currently is serve as a network interface for my Drobo. So you can get pretty creative about this stuff with respect to the storage space. And I am just if you can't tell already, a huge fan of ChronoSync. I think it's really easy to set up, and you can set up all kinds of different syncing rules. I have a bunch of different rules for different types of files, my email and certain critical documents, and I get all of that stuff backed up to my Drobo. And the advantage of the Drobo is as I run out of storage space, I can just pop in bigger and bigger drives and keep expanding that, so I don't have to worry about it too much. But as with all backup solutions for both of you, just make sure you have multiple copies, and hopefully this gives you some ideas of some possible solutions, and maybe some of you have some additional recommendations and some creative ways for handling this sort of stuff. If you want to send me some email, you can send email mattcast@gmail.com. Let me know what kinds of solutions you're using for your network backups. So if you've been lucky enough to be the recipient or to go out and buy a new Mac in the past couple years, it may be that you have an older Mac lying around that you're thinking about either handing down or maybe selling or doing something with. Maybe you got a shiny new Haswell MacBook Air and I'm completely jealous of you and you have your old Mac and you're wondering what to do with it, or you want to hand it down to a friend, a family member, or just simply sell it. Well, ZDNet actually found a great Apple support article that has all the details you need to know to get your machine ready to actually transfer it to a new owner. It kind of covers all of the steps that I often get asked about. A lot of people will ask me, hey, I have this old Mac, but I want to make sure all of my data is off of it and I don't have any issues. And so I'll link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, but I thought I'd cover the steps real quickly for you. And the number one step in this article is the one that I always forget about. And that is deauthorizing your computer in iTunes, because with iTunes DRM, the FairPlay licensing, you know, you can only have 5 Macs hooked up to iTunes or authorized with iTunes. And yeah, they'll let you go in and deauthorize, but you have to deauthorize like all 5 computers at the same time if you forget to do it from within iTunes itself. So if you have to actually log into the iTunes account administration area, you can only deauthorize all your computers at once, and then you got to go back and reauthorize everything. It's much easier if you open up iTunes before you erase the hard drive on your computer, before you do anything else, and deauthorize iTunes. So to do that, you go ahead and you open up iTunes, and then from the store menu, there is a deauthorize this computer option. You just simply choose that and it will deauthorize it. If you have an earlier version of iTunes, I think it's under the advanced menu. So you'll find it there, and you'll have to enter your Apple ID and password and then click the deauthorize button. The second step is to back up your data. But really, this would be the alpha step or the zero step, because you're a MacCast listener, right? So you've already done this step, and you've done it multiple times and in multiple places, right? All right, well, if you haven't, back up your data, runtime machine, do carbon copy cloner, super duper, copy them to a USB drive, however you want to do it, get your critical files and documents off of there. You've probably also already transferred them to your new Mac, but you know, make sure you have a backup of the old stuff too. It's good just to have that extra backup around. And then once you've done that, if you've enabled it, you probably want to turn off Find My Mac and sign out of iCloud, or you absolutely want to do those things if you've enabled them. So go into System Preferences under iCloud, deselect the Find My Mac option, and disconnect your device from iCloud. Also, sign out of iCloud over on the left-hand side. And when you sign out of iCloud, the system automatically removes your iCloud data from your Mac. So again, make sure you've backed up all of those critical files and documents and things like that before you do this step. You know, make sure you have that copy of your contacts and your calendar events and all those important critical things. And as a matter of fact, I think the article that Apple has up there specifically at the top warns you about removing the iCloud data and making sure that you have that transferred over and moved to your new system. And then after you've taken care of all of that, only then will you reformat your hard drive and reinstall the operating system that came with your Mac. So from the Apple menu, choose restart or just restart your Mac and then hold down the option and R key to boot into the recovery partition. If you're not connected to the internet, you'll have to choose your network from Wi-Fi. You'll have to choose your Wi-Fi network so you can get connected. And then once it boots up into recovery mode, you want to select the disk utility option and then click continue, and then select the startup disk on your Mac from the left hand side, and then go ahead and hit the erase tab to erase it. And for format, you want to choose Mac OS X extended journaled, enter a name for the disk, and hit erase. And then after it's been erased, you can go ahead and quit disk utility. That'll put you back into the Mac OS X installer, and you can reinstall OS X on the new Mac. And then the last little tip that's really cool, if you're going to be handing it down or sending it off to somebody, everybody wants to have that out-of-box experience, right? You remember the first time you got your Mac and it brought up the setup assistant and walked you through all those steps of pulling over your old data from your Time Machine backup and all that stuff? You want your new owner, the person you're giving it to have that experience. Well, once you install the operating system, it restarts and it comes up into that setup assistant mode. If you actually just hit Command Q, it will shut down the Mac from the welcome screen. And I didn't know you could do this. It'll actually shut down the Mac and then you're done. So the next time it boots up, it'll go right into that setup mode, just like it was new out of the box. Pretty nice, huh? Yeah, so do that for your users. But that's how you prep a Mac system for resale or to give away to somebody. And again, I'll have a link to the Apple article in the show notes at maccast.com. Received a great and very interesting question from Nick. And it was one that at first would seem like you didn't need to ask, like almost like comparing apples to oranges, but it's actually something that I've talked about with other people and actually mulled over myself. And that is, I need to get a new Apple laptop or a new Apple iPad, but the MacBook Air and the iPad, the low-end iPad, are pretty close to each other in terms of specs. How do I decide which one is the right one for me? And in Nick's case, he was saying he has an aging original generation, first generation iPad. They also only have one Mac currently in their family, and it's his wife's iMac. They're actually sharing it. And so Nick was saying, you know, I use the Mac, the iMac on occasion, but mostly I use the iPad. And when I'm using the iPad, most of my usage is surrounding media consumption and browsing. I listen to music. He uses Apple lossless files. So Nick, I'm assuming you're an audiophile if you're recording into that format or ripping into that format. And then also watches movies on Netflix and Amazon streaming, surfs the web, reads emails, does all those things on his current iPad. And the iMac that they have is a 3 terabyte model, but the hard drive is getting really, really full, mainly because of Nick's large Apple lossless music collection, which is on an external FireWire drive. It's not even on the internal 3 terabyte drive. So I guess you got a bunch of other stuff, maybe photos and things like that on that internal drive, huh, Nick? But here's the thing. You know, you could wait and get a new 5th generation iPad, hopefully in the fall when they come out. They've got those shiny new 11-inch MacBook Airs. But when you start specking and pricing them out, right, they're pretty close. I was looking at it, and the 128 gigabyte model iPad with the Retina display, the fourth generation one currently, is $799 US, and that gives you 10 hours of battery life. You have the 9.7-inch screen, and it weighs 1.44 pounds. For $200 more and 1 pound more, you have the 128-gigabyte 11-inch MacBook Air. It's $999 US. It gives you 9 hours of battery life, so almost the same as the iPad. A larger 11.6-inch screen, although it's not Retina, and is 2.38 pounds. Now, the advantage of the MacBook Air, of course, is that it also has a keyboard and Thunderbolt port and two USB 3 ports. So you can do arguably a lot more with it than you could with just a shiny new iPad. You do give up some of the size and portability and the Retina screen. And the one advantage the iPad has also is it has that nice rear-facing camera. So if you're out and about and want to snap some pictures, that's easier to do than with a MacBook Air. But I can see the dilemma, right? These are pretty close in terms of their specs. But in my case, I'm thinking, Nick, for you, it sounds like I would go for the MacBook Air rather than the iPad, mainly because I see an iPad as a supplemental device to my Mac and not necessarily a replacement. And since you don't have your own Mac, I think it's kind of a nice compromise. You get a lot of the portability that you have with the iPad, but a lot more functionality and use cases with the MacBook Air. And you're right, it's about a $200 price difference, especially if you were considering the larger 128 gigabyte version of the iPad. And it sounds like you were because of the amount of music that you manage and listen to. So that was my sort of gut reaction. I'd be curious to find out what you think. If you think Nick should go for the iPad or the MacBook Air, or if you've gone through this sort of quandary yourself, let us know how you ended up resolving it. As a side note, I want to mention something Nick also said in his email, mentioned a piece of software that I had not heard about for managing a large music collection. Now, I just have simply moved mine onto an external drive, and I deal with the dilemmas and issues there. But Nick mentioned an app called TuneSpan, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But in essence, TuneSpan lets you split up the locations of different portions of your iTunes media library, either on a single drive or across multiple drives. And I've often thought about this, like my movie library, I'm buying more movies on iTunes, and so that's eating up more and more of my hard drive space. And I'd be really nice to get a dedicated drive just for my iTunes movie files. And apparently with TuneSpan, you can do this. Now, I've never used it. I can't vouch for how well it works or its accuracy, but I was looking into some of the details that they have on their website. And in essence, what it looks like it does is you define where you want these files to go, and then it copies those files from your main iTunes library and puts them in the location you want them, and then runs an Apple script command called set location that goes in and updates the iTunes metadata, the library XML file, with the new paths and locations, and will kind of continue to update that when you run the application and as you move things around and put them in different locations. It can also clean up some of the files in your iTunes media folder after it's done copying them. So it does a copy first. It doesn't actually delete the original files, but if you want, it'll go through, and once it's verified it's copied everything over to the new location, you can have it sweep through your iTunes media folder and move those files to the trash. Again, it won't delete them, but it'll move them to the trash. You can review them, make sure that everything's good and working, and then delete them yourself. So cool little app and probably worth looking into. Nick, you didn't mention if you'd been using the application and how well it's working. So if you have been using it, or if one of you have been using it, let us know. Give us a little review of TuneSpan. But I had not heard of that application before. I guess it's available on the Mac App Store and might be worth checking out for those of you who have large iTunes media libraries that are becoming a little bit unwieldy. And then the last thing that I have for you today is something that keeps cropping up for me, actually more frequently than I thought it would since moving to Mountain Lion, and that is running across software and applications that I will download and run, and the apps are not signed by the developers with an Apple ID, meaning that in Mountain Lion, with its new gatekeeper technology, it will not open the application without you actually giving it some special permission or changing the settings on your Mac. Out of the box, when you install Mountain Lion, the gatekeeper settings say that you can only open and run applications that are either from the Mac App Store or that are signed with a developer's application ID. And you can actually go into your system preferences, into the security preferences under general, and change the setting. There's a setting that says allow applications downloaded from, and then you have the three different options. The most restrictive is the Mac App Store only, so it'll only launch applications from the Mac App Store. The next setting, which is that default setting, is either from the Mac App Store or signed with a developer's Apple ID. And then the last option is anywhere. So if you switch to anywhere, it will let you launch any application you download from the internet, but that is inherently less secure. And personally, I like to know when an app is signed by a developer or not, and then be able to make that decision. Yes, do I want to install this? Do I know where it came from? The whole idea here is to prevent any malware. If you accidentally downloaded an app or an application, tried to launch and install an application, something else that you downloaded, a piece of malware, where without you knowing it, you would be notified as long as the gatekeeper settings were in effect. And luckily, there is a really easy way to make a one-time exception if you can remember the trick. I kept forgetting the trick. I thought it was holding down the option key when you were launching the application, but that's not right. That's not how you do it. Actually, all you have to do is the first time that you open an application after downloading it, you simply right-click on the application's icon and choose open from the contextual menu. And that way you will get a dialog that will pop up that will warn you that the app isn't signed or from the Mac App Store, but gives you the option to open and run it anyway. And once you click the open option, then from that point on, that application will launch without interrupting you or bothering you anymore. You can run the application normally from that point forward. And this came up because I had recommended the application for ripping DVDs that I've been using called IVI Pro. And that application, for whatever reason, maybe an obvious reason, is not signed with an Apple ID by the developer, but it was a known application. I trusted being able to download it, and I went ahead and just launched it. But the first time I tried to run the application, it wouldn't run. It popped up a dialogue saying that it wasn't signed. Gatekeeper came into effect, and then all you can do at that point is close the application. So the way to get around that, again, right-click or control-click on the application icon and choose open, and that will give you the prompt so you can actually do the override, the other method being just changing your setting, but I didn't want to go that far. So that's how you can get around an application that hasn't been signed by the developer, and I'm really hoping that more and more developers are going to opt for using their Apple ID and signing their applications. I think from a consumer perspective, it gives the consumer a better peace of mind knowing that the application is coming from a registered developer, and it just adds that extra level of security and safety. And I think that's a good thing. But there's always going to be these applications for one reason or another that aren't signed by the developer, and then at least we know we can make the choice to actually run that on our system. So that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iOS, and Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. You can get more information and details on their software over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can try out GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com and click the Try It Free button. Use my promo code MACCAST when you sign up. Gazelle, it's the fast and easy way to sell your used gadget. You can find out what your iPhone, your iPad, your MacBook, or even your Samsung Galaxy S smartphone is worth simply by going to gazelle.com. Squarespace, it really is probably about the easiest way to create a beautiful and intuitive website. They have templates for web pages, blogs, online stores, galleries, and you do everything from a single platform. You can try it free. No credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com to sign up now and use the offer code MACCAST6 to get 10% off your first order. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sending and sharing your business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP by using ShareFile. You can try it free, risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. If you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, you can send your emails and your audio files to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line. That's 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IM-9 is the phone number. And feel free to also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus. Just search for MacCast and you'll find me on all of the social media sites, app.net, what have you. And I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.